Disc 16.
Chapter 50. Dorothea had been safe at Freshitt Hall nearly a week before she had asked any dangerous questions. Every morning now, she sat with Celia in the prettiest of upstairs sitting rooms, opening into a small conservatory. Celia, all in white and lavender like a bunch of mixed violets, watching the remarkable acts of the baby, which were so dubious to her inexperienced mind that all conversation was interrupted by appeals for their interpretation made to the oracular nurse. Dorothea sat by in her widow's dress, with an expression which rather provoked Celia as being much too sad, for not only was baby quite well, but really, when her husband had been so dull and troublesome while he lived, and besides that had... well, well... Sir James, of course, had told Celia everything, with a strong representation how important it was that Dorothea should not know it sooner than was inevitable. But Mr. Brooke had been right in predicting that Dorothea would not long remain passive where action had been assigned to her. She knew the purport of her husband's will made at the time of their marriage, and her mind, as soon as she was clearly conscious of her position, was silently occupied with what she ought to do as the owner of Lowick Manor, with the patronage of the living attached to it. One morning, when her uncle paid his usual visit, though with an unusual alacrity in his manner, which he accounted for by saying that it was now pretty certain Parliament would be dissolved forthwith, Dorothea said, "Uncle, it is right now that I should consider who is to have the living at Lowick. After Mr. Tucker had been provided for, I never heard my husband say that he had any clergyman in his mind as a successor to himself. I think I ought to have the keys now, and go to Lowick to examine all my husband's papers. There may be something that would throw light on his wishes."
"No hurry, my dear," said Mr. Brooke quietly. "By and by, you know, you can go if you like. But I cast my eyes over things in the desks and drawers. There was nothing but deep subjects, you know, besides the will. Everything can be done by and by. As to the living, I have had an application for interest already. I should say rather good. Mr. Tyke has been strongly recommended to me. I had something to do with getting him an appointment before. An apostolic man, I believe. The sort of thing that would suit you, my dear."
"I should like to have fuller knowledge about him, Uncle, and judge for myself, if Mr. Casaubon has not left any expression of his wishes. He has perhaps made some addition to his will. There may be some instructions for me," said Dorothea, who had all the while had this conjecture in her mind with relation to her husband's work.
"Nothing about the rectory, my dear, nothing," said Mr. Brooke, rising to go away and putting out his hand to his nieces. "Nor about his researches, you know. Nothing in the will."
Dorothea's lip quivered.
"Come, you must not think of these things yet, my dear. By and by, you know."
"I am quite well now, Uncle. I wish to exert myself."
"Well, well, we shall see. But I must run away now. I have no end of work now. It's a crisis, a political crisis, you know. And here is Celia and her little man. You are an aunt, you know, now, and I am a sort of grandfather," said Mr. Brooke, with placid hurry, anxious to get away and tell Chetham that it would not be his, Mr. Brooke's, fault if Dorothea insisted on looking into everything.
Dorothea sank back in her chair when her uncle had left the room, and cast her eyes down meditatively on her crossed hands.
"Look, Dodo, look at him. Did you ever see anything like that?" said Celia, in her comfortable staccato.
"What, Kitty?"
said Dorothea, lifting her eyes rather absently.
"What? Why, his upper lip. See how he is drawing it down as if he meant to make a face. Isn't it wonderful? He may have his little thoughts. I wish Nurse were here. Do look at him."
A large tear, which had been for some time gathering, rolled down Dorothea's cheek as she looked up and tried to smile.
"Don't be sad, Dodo. Kiss baby. What are you brooding over so? I am sure you did everything, and a great deal too much. You should be happy now."
I wonder if Sir James would drive me to Lowick. I want to look over everything, to see if there were any words written for me.
You are not to go till Mr. Lydgate says you may go, and he has not said so yet. Here you are, nurse. Take baby and walk up and down the gallery. Besides, you have got a wrong notion in your head as usual, Dodo. I can see that. It vexes me.
Where am I wrong, Kitty? Said Dorothea, quite meekly. She was almost ready now to think Celia wiser than herself, and was really wondering with some fear what her wrong notion was. Celia felt her advantage and was determined to use it. None of them knew Dodo as well as she did, or knew how to manage her. Since Celia's baby was born, she had had a new sense of her mental solidity and calm wisdom. It seemed clear that where there was a baby, things were right enough, and that error, in general, was a mere lack of that central poising force.
"I can see what you are thinking of as well as can be, Dodo," said Celia. "You are wanting to find out if there is anything uncomfortable for you to do now, only because Mr. Casaubon wished it, as if you had not been uncomfortable enough before. And he doesn't deserve it, and you will find that out. He has behaved very badly. James is as angry with him as can be, and I had better tell you to prepare you."
"Celia," said Dorothea entreatingly, "you distress me. Tell me at once what you mean." It glanced through her mind that Mr. Casaubon had left the property away from her, which would not be so very distressing.
"Why, he has made a codicil to his will to say the property was all to go away from you if you married... I mean..."
"That is of no consequence," said Dorothea, breaking in impetuously.
"But if you married Mr. Ladislaw, not anybody else," Celia went on with persevering quietude. "Of course, that is of no consequence in one way. You never would marry Mr. Ladislaw, but that only makes it worse of Mr. Casaubon."
The blood rushed to Dorothea's face and neck, painfully. But Celia was administering what she thought a sobering dose of fact. It was taking up notions that had done Dodo's health so much harm. So she went on in her neutral tone, as if she had been remarking on baby's robes.
"James says so. He says it is abominable, and not like a gentleman. And there never was a better judge than James. It is as if Mr. Casaubon wanted to make people believe that you would wish to marry Mr. Ladislaw, which is ridiculous. Only James says it was to hinder Mr. Ladislaw from wanting to marry you for your money. Just as if he ever would think of making you an offer. Mrs. Cadwallader said you might as well marry an Italian with white mice. But I must just go and look at baby," Celia added without the least change of tone, throwing a light shawl over her and tripping away. Dorothea by this time had turned cold again, and now threw herself back helplessly in her chair. She might have compared her experience at that moment to the vague, alarmed consciousness that her life was taking on a new form, that she was undergoing a metamorphosis in which memory would not adjust itself to the stirring of new organs. Everything was changing its aspect: her husband's conduct, her own duteous feeling towards him, every struggle between them, and yet more, her whole relation to Will Ladislaw. Her world was in a state of convulsive change. The only thing she could say distinctly to herself was that she must wait and think anew. One change terrified her as if it had been a sin. It was a violent shock of repulsion from her departed husband, who had had hidden thoughts, perhaps perverting everything she said and did. Then again, she was conscious of another change, which also made her tremulous. It was a sudden, strange yearning of heart towards Will Ladislaw. It had never before entered her mind that he could, under any circumstances, be her lover. Conceive the effect of the sudden revelation that another had thought of him in that light, that perhaps he himself had been conscious of such a possibility. And this, with the hurrying, crowding vision of unfitting conditions and questions not soon to be solved. It seemed a long while, she did not know how long, before she heard Celia saying, "That will do, nurse. He will be quiet on my lap now. You can go to lunch and let Garrett stay in the next room." "What I think, Dodo," Celia went on, observing nothing more than that Dorothea was leaning back in her chair and likely to be passive, is that Mr. Casaubon was spiteful. I never did like him, and James never did. I think the corners of his mouth were dreadfully spiteful. And now he has behaved in this way, I am sure religion does not require you to make yourself uncomfortable about him. If he has been taken away, that is a mercy, and you ought to be grateful. We should not grieve, should we, baby?
Said Celia, confidentially, to that unconscious centre and poise of the world, who had the most remarkable fists, all complete, even to the nails, and hair enough, really, when you took his cap off, to make you didn't know what. In short, he was a Buddha in a Western form. At this crisis, Lydgate was announced, and one of the first things he said was, "I fear you are not so well as you were, Mrs. Casaubon. Have you been agitated? Allow me to feel your pulse." Dorothea's hand was of a marble coldness.
"She wants to go to Lowick to look over papers," said Celia. "She ought not, ought she?"
Lydgate did not speak for a few moments. Then he said, looking at Dorothea, "I hardly know. In my opinion, Mrs. Casaubon should do what would give her the most repose of mind. That repose will not always come from being forbidden to act."
"Thank you," said Dorothea, exerting herself. "I am sure that is wise. There are so many things which I ought to attend to. Why should I sit here idle?"
Then, with an effort to recall subjects not connected with her agitation, she added abruptly, "You know everyone in Middlemarch, I think, Mr. Lydgate. I shall ask you to tell me a great deal. I have serious things to do now. I have a living to give away. You know Mr. Tyke and all..." But Dorothea's effort was too much for her. She broke off and burst into sobs. Lydgate made her drink a dose of sal volatile. "Let Mrs. Casaubon do as she likes," he said to Sir James, whom he asked to see before quitting the house. "She wants perfect freedom, I think, more than any other prescription." His attendance on Dorothea while her brain was excited had enabled him to form some true conclusions concerning the trials of her life. He felt sure that she had been suffering from the strain and conflict of self-repression, and that she was likely now to feel herself only in another sort of pinfold than that from which she had been released. Lydgate's advice was all the easier for Sir James to follow when he found that Celia had already told Dorothea the unpleasant fact about the will. There was no help for it now, no reason for any further delay in the execution of necessary business. And the next day, Sir James complied at once with her request that he would drive her to Lowick.
"I have no wish to stay there at present," said Dorothea. "I could hardly bear it. I am much happier at Freshit with Celia. I shall be able to think better about what should be done at Lowick by looking at it from a distance. And I should like to be at the Grange a little while with my uncle, and go about in all the old walks and among the people in the village."
"Not yet, I think. Your uncle is having political company, and you are better out of the way of such doings," said Sir James, who at that moment thought of the Grange chiefly as a haunt of young Ladislaus. But no word passed between him and Dorothea about the objectionable part of the will. Indeed, both of them felt that the mention of it between them would be impossible. Sir James was shy, even with men, about disagreeable subjects, and the one thing that Dorothea would have chosen to say, if she had spoken on the matter at all, was forbidden to her at present, because it seemed to be a further exposure of her husband's injustice. Yet she did wish that Sir James could know what had passed between her and her husband about Will Ladislaw's moral claim on the property. It would then, she thought, be apparent to him as it was to her that her husband's strange, indelicate proviso had been chiefly urged by his bitter resistance to that idea of claim and not merely by personal feelings more difficult to talk about. Also, it must be admitted, Dorothea wished that this could be known for Will's sake, since her friends seemed to think of him as simply an object of Mr. Casaubon's charity. Why should he be compared with an Italian carrying white mice? That word, quoted from Mrs. Cadwallader, seemed like a mocking travesty wrought in the dark by an impish finger. At Lowick, Dorothea searched desk and drawer, searched all her husband's places of deposit for private writing, but found no paper addressed especially to her, except that synoptical tabulation, which was probably only the beginning of many intended directions for her guidance. In carrying out this bequest of labour to Dorothea, as in all else,
Mr. Casaubon had been slow and hesitating, oppressed in the plan of transmitting his work, as he had been in executing it, by the sense of moving heavily in a dim and clogging medium. Distrust of Dorothea's competence to arrange what he had prepared was subdued only by distrust of any other redactor. But he had come at last to create a trust for himself out of Dorothea's nature. She could do what she resolved to do. And he willingly imagined her toiling under the fetters of a promise to erect a tomb with his name upon it. Not that Mr. Casaubon called the future volumes a tomb. He called them the key to all mythologies. But the months gained on him and left his plans belated. He had only had time to ask for that promise by which he sought to keep his cold grasp on Dorothea's life. The grasp had slipped away. Bound by a pledge given from the depths of her pity, she would have been capable of undertaking a toil which her judgment whispered was vain for all uses except that consecration of faithfulness which is a supreme use. But now her judgment, instead of being controlled by duteous devotion, was made active by the embittering discovery that in her past union there had lurked the hidden alienation of secrecy and suspicion. The living, suffering man was no longer before her to awaken her pity. There remained only the retrospect of painful subjection to a husband whose thoughts had been lower than she had believed, whose exorbitant claims for himself had even blinded his scrupulous care for his own character and made him defeat his own pride by shocking men of ordinary honour. As for the property, which was the sign of that broken tie, she would have been glad to be free from it and have nothing more than her original fortune which had been settled on her, if there had not been duties attached to ownership which she ought not to flinch from. About this property, many troublous questions insisted on rising. Had she not been right in thinking that the half of it ought to go to Will Ladislaw? But was it not impossible now for her to do that act of justice? Mr. Casaubon had taken a cruelly effective means of hindering her. Even with indignation against him in her heart, any act that seemed a triumphant eluding of his purpose revolted her. After collecting papers of business which she wished to examine, she locked up again the desks and drawers, all empty of personal words for her, empty of any sign that in her husband's lonely brooding his heart had gone out to her in excuse or explanation. And she went back to Freshett with the sense that around his last hard demand and his last injurious assertion of his power, the silence was unbroken. Dorothea tried now to turn her thoughts towards immediate duties, and one of these was of a kind which others were determined to remind her of. Lydgate's ear had caught eagerly her mention of the living, and as soon as he could, he reopened the subject, seeing here a possibility of making amends for the casting vote he had once given with an ill-satisfied conscience. "Instead of telling you anything about Mr. Tyke," he said, "I should like to speak of another man, Mr. Fairbrother, the Vicar of St. Botolph's. His living is a poor one, and gives him a stinted provision for himself and his family. His mother, aunt, and sister all live with him and depend upon him. I believe he has never married because of them. I never heard such good preaching as his, such plain, easy eloquence. He would have done to preach at St. Paul's Cross after old Latimer. His talk is just as good about all subjects, original, simple, clear. I think him a remarkable fellow. He ought to have done more than he has done." "Why has he not done more?" said Dorothea, interested now in all who had slipped below their own intention. "That's a hard question," said Lydgate. "I find myself that it's uncommonly difficult to make the right thing work. There are so many strings pulling at once. Fairbrother often hints that he has got into the wrong profession. He wants a wider range than that of a poor clergyman. And I suppose he has no interest to help him on. He is very fond of natural history and various scientific matters, and he is hampered in reconciling these tastes with his position. He has no money to spare, hardly enough to use, and that has led him into card playing. Middlemarch is a great place for whist. He does play for money and wins a good deal. Of course, that takes him into company a little beneath him and makes him slack about some things. And yet, with all that, looking at him as a whole, I think he is one of the most blameless men I ever knew. He has neither venom nor doubleness in him, and those often go with a more correct outside.
"I wonder whether he suffers in his conscience because of that habit," said Dorothea. "I wonder whether he wishes he could leave it off."
"I have no doubt he would leave it off if he were transplanted into plenty. He would be glad of the time for other things."
"My uncle says that Mr. Tyke is spoken of as an apostolic man," said Dorothea meditatively. She was wishing it were possible to restore the times of primitive zeal, and yet thinking of Mr. Fairbrother with a strong desire to rescue him from his chance-gotten money.
"I don't pretend to say that Fairbrother is apostolic," said Lydgate. "His position is not quite like that of the apostles. He is only a parson among parishioners whose lives he has to try and make better. Practically, I find that what is called being apostolic now is an impatience of everything in which the parson doesn't cut the principal figure. I see something of that in Mr. Tyke at the hospital. A good deal of his doctrine is a sort of pinching hard to make people uncomfortably aware of him. Besides, an apostolic man at Lowick? He ought to think, as St. Francis did, that it is needful to preach to the birds."
"True," said Dorothea. "It is hard to imagine what sort of notions our farmers and labourers get from their teaching. I have been looking into a volume of sermons by Mr. Tyke. Such sermons would be of no use at Lowick. I mean, about imputed righteousness and the prophecies in the Apocalypse. I have always been thinking of the different ways in which Christianity is taught, and whenever I find one way that makes it a wider blessing than any other, I cling to that as the truest. I mean, that which takes in the most good of all kinds and brings in the most people as sharers in it. It is surely better to pardon too much than to condemn too much. But I should like to see Mr. Fairbrother and hear him preach."
"Do," said Lydgate. "I trust to the effect of that. He is very much beloved, but he has his enemies too. There are always people who can't forgive an able man for differing from them. And that money-winning business is really a blot. You don't, of course, see many Middlemarch people, but Mr. Ladislaw, who is constantly seeing Mr. Brooke, is a great friend of Mr. Fairbrother's old ladies, and would be glad to sing the vicar's praises. One of the old ladies, Miss Noble, the aunt, is a wonderfully quaint picture of self-forgetful goodness, and Ladislaw gallants her about sometimes. I met them one day in a back street. You know Ladislaw's look, a sort of Daphnis in coat and waistcoat, and this little old maid reaching up to his arm. They looked like a couple dropped out of a romantic comedy. But the best evidence about Fairbrother is to see him and hear him." Happily, Dorothea was in her private sitting room when this conversation occurred, and there was no one present to make Lydgate's innocent introduction of Ladislaw painful to her. As was usual with him in matters of personal gossip, Lydgate had quite forgotten Rosamond's remark that she thought Will adored Mrs. Casaubon. At that moment he was only caring for what would recommend the Fairbrother family, and he had purposely given emphasis to the worst that could be said about the vicar in order to forestall objections. In the weeks since Mr. Casaubon's death he had hardly seen Ladislaw, and he had heard no rumour to warn him that Mr. Brooke's confidential secretary was a dangerous subject with Mrs. Casaubon. When he was gone, his picture of Ladislaw lingered in her mind and disputed the ground with that question of the Lowick living. What was Will Ladislaw thinking about her? Would he hear of that fact which made her cheeks burn as they never used to do? And how would he feel when he heard it? But she could see as well as possible how he smiled down at the little old maid. An Italian with white mice. On the contrary, he was a creature who entered into everyone's feelings and could take the pressure of their thought instead of urging his own with iron resistance. Chapter 51. No gossip about Mr. Casaubon's will had yet reached Ladislaw. The air seemed to be filled with the dissolution of Parliament and the coming election, as the old wakes and fairs were filled with the rival chatter of itinerant shows, and more private noises were taken little notice of. The famous dry election was at hand, in which the depths of public feeling might be measured by the low flood mark of drink. Will Ladislaw was one of the busiest at this time, and though Dorothea's widowhood was continually in his thought, He was so far from wishing to be spoken to on the subject that when Lydgate sought him out to tell him what had passed about the Lowick living, he answered rather waspishly, "Why should you bring me into the matter? I never see Mrs. Casaubon, and I'm not likely to see her, since she is at Freshett. I never go there. It is Tory ground, where I and the pioneer are no more welcome than a poacher in his gun." The fact was that Will had been made the more susceptible by observing that Mr. Brooke, instead of wishing him, as before, to come to the Grange oftener than was quite agreeable to himself, seemed now to contrive that he should go there as little as possible. This was a shuffling concession of Mr. Brooke's to Sir James Chettam's indignant remonstrance, and Will, awake to the slightest hint in this direction, concluded that he was to be kept away from the Grange on Dorothea's account. Her friends then regarded him with some suspicion. Their fears were quite superfluous. They were very much mistaken if they imagined that he would put himself forward as a needy adventurer trying to win the favour of a rich woman. Until now, Will had never fully seen the chasm between himself and Dorothea, until now that he was come to the brink of it and saw her on the other side. He began, not without some inward rage, to think of going away from the neighbourhood. It would be impossible for him to show any further interest in Dorothea without subjecting himself to disagreeable imputations, perhaps even in her mind, which others might try to poison. "We are forever divided," said Will. "I might as well be at Rome. She would be no farther from me." But what we call our despair is often only the painful eagerness of unfed hope. There were plenty of reasons why he should not go, public reasons why he should not quit his post at this crisis, leaving Mr. Brooke in the lurch when he needed coaching for the election, and when there was so much canvassing, direct and indirect, to be carried on. Will could not like to leave his own chessmen in the heat of a game, and any candidate on the right side, even if his brain and marrow had been as soft as was consistent with a gentlemanly bearing, might help to turn a majority. To coach Mr. Brooke and keep him steadily to the idea that he must pledge himself to vote for the actual Reform Bill, instead of insisting on his independence and power of pulling up in time, was not an easy task. Mr. Fairbrother's prophecy of a fourth candidate in the bag had not yet been fulfilled. Neither the Parliamentary Candidate Society, nor any other power on the watch to secure a reforming majority, seeing a worthy nodus for interference, while there was a second reforming candidate like Mr. Brooke, who might be returned at his own expense. And the fight lay entirely between Pinkerton, the old Tory member, Bagster, the new Whig member returned at the last election, and Brooke, the future independent member, who was to fetter himself for this occasion only. Mr. Hawley and his party would bend all their forces to the return of Pinkerton, and Mr. Brooke's success must depend either on plumpers, which would leave Bagster in the rear, or on the new minting of Tory votes into reforming votes. The latter means, of course, would be preferable. This prospect of converting votes was a dangerous distraction to Mr. Brooke. His impression that waverers were likely to be allured by wavering statements, and also the liability of his mind to stick afresh at opposing arguments as they turned up in his memory, gave Will Ladislaw much trouble. "You know there are tactics in these things," said Mr. Brooke. "Meeting people halfway, tempering your ideas, saying, 'Well, now, there's something in that,' and so on. I agree with you that this is a peculiar occasion, the country with a will of its own, political unions, that sort of thing. But we sometimes cut with rather too sharp a knife, Ladislaw. These 10-pound householders now, why 10? Draw the line somewhere, yes, but why just at 10? That's a difficult question now, if you go into it." "Of course it is," said Will impatiently. "But if you were to wait till we get a logical bill, you must put yourself forward as a revolutionist, and then Middlemarch would not elect you, I fancy. As for trimming, this is not a time for trimming." Mr. Brooke always ended by agreeing with Ladislaw, who still appeared to him a sort of Burke with a leaven of Shelley. But after an interval, the wisdom of his own methods reasserted itself, and he was again drawn into using them with much hopefulness. At this stage of affairs he was in excellent spirits, which even supported him under large advances of money, for his powers of convincing and persuading had not yet been tested by anything more difficult than a chairman's speech introducing other orators, or a dialogue with a Middlemarch voter from which he came away with a sense that he was a tactician by nature, and that it was a pity he had not gone earlier into this kind of thing. He was a little conscious of defeat, however, with Mr. Mormsey, a chief representative in Middlemarch of that great social power, the retail trader, and naturally one of the most doubtful voters in the borough, willing for his own part to supply an equal quality of teas and sugars to reformer and anti-reformer, as well as to agree impartially with both, and feeling, like the burgesses of old, that this necessity of electing members was a great burthen to a town. For even if there were no danger in holding out hopes to all parties beforehand, there would be the painful necessity at last of disappointing respectable people whose names were on his books. He was accustomed to receive large orders from Mr. Brooke of Tipton, but then there were many of Pinkerton's committee whose opinions had a great weight of grocery on their side. Mr. Mormsey, thinking that Mr. Brooke, as not too clever in his intellects, was the more likely to forgive a grocer who gave a hostile vote under pressure, had become confidential in his back parlour.
"As to reform, sir, put it in a family light," he said, rattling the small silver in his pocket and smiling affably. "Will it support Mrs. Mormsey, and enable her to bring up 6 children when I am no more? I put the question fictitiously, knowing what must be the answer. Very well, sir. I ask you what, as a husband and a father, I am to do when gentlemen come to me and say, 'Do as you like, Mormsey, but if you vote against us, I shall get my groceries elsewhere.' When I sugar my liquor, I like to feel that I am benefiting the country by maintaining tradesmen of the right colour. Those very words have been spoken to me, sir, in the very chair where you are now sitting. I don't mean by your honourable self, Mr. Brooke."
"No, no, no, that's narrow, you know. Until my butler complains to me of your goods, Mr. Mormsey," said Mr. Brooke, soothingly, "until I hear that you send bad sugars, spices, that sort of thing, I shall never order him to go elsewhere."
"Sir, I am your humble servant and greatly obliged," said Mr. Mormsey, feeling that politics were clearing up a little. "There would be some pleasure in voting for a gentleman who speaks in that honourable manner."
"Well, you know, Mr. Mormsey, you would find it the right thing to put yourself on our side. This reform will touch everybody by and by. A thoroughly popular measure, a sort of ABC, you know, that must come first before the rest can follow. I quite agree with you that you've got to look at the thing in a family light, but public spirit now. We're all one family, you know. It's all one cupboard. Such a thing as a vote now. Why, it may help to make men's fortunes at the Cape. There's no knowing what may be the effect of a vote."
Mr. Brooke ended with a sense of being a little out at sea, though finding it still enjoyable. But Mr. Mormsey answered in a tone of decisive check.
"I beg your pardon, sir, but I can't afford that. When I give a vote, I must know what I'm doing. I must look to what will be the effects on my till and ledger, speaking respectfully. Prices, I'll admit, are what nobody can know the merits of, and the sudden falls after you've bought in currants, which are a goods that will not keep, I've never myself seen into the ins and outs there, which is a rebuke to human pride. But as to one family, there's debtor and creditor, I hope. They're not going to reform that away, else I should vote for things staying as they are. Few men have less need to cry for change than I have, personally speaking. That is for self and family. I am not one of those who have nothing to lose. I mean as to respectability both in parish and private business, and no ways in respect of your honourable self and custom, which you was good enough to say you would not withdraw from me, vote or no vote, while the article sent in was satisfactory."
After this conversation, Mr. Mormsey went up and boasted to his wife that he had been rather too many for Brooke of Tipton, and that he didn't mind so much now about going to the poll. Mr. Brooke, on this occasion, abstained from boasting of his tactics to Ladislaw, who, for his part, was glad enough to persuade himself that he had no concern with any canvassing except the purely argumentative sort, and that he worked no meaner engine than knowledge. Mr. Brooke necessarily had his agents, who understood the nature of the Middlemarch voter and the means of enlisting his ignorance on the side of the bill, which were remarkably similar to the means of enlisting it on the side against the bill. Will stopped his ears. Occasionally Parliament, like the rest of our lives, even to our eating and apparel, could hardly go on if our imaginations were too active about processes. There were plenty of dirty-handed men in the world to do dirty business, and Will protested to himself that his share in bringing Mr. Brooke through would be quite innocent. But whether he should succeed in that mode of contributing to the majority on the right side was very doubtful to him. He had written out various speeches and memoranda for speeches, but he had begun to perceive that Mr. Brooke's mind, if it had the burthen of remembering any train of thought, would let it drop, run away in search of it, and not easily come back again. To collect documents is one mode of serving your country, and to remember the contents of a document is another. No, the only way in which Mr. Brooke could be coerced into thinking of the right arguments at the right time was to be well plied with them till they took up all the room in his brain. But here there was the difficulty of finding room, so many things having been taken in beforehand. Mr. Brooke himself observed that his ideas stood rather in his way when he was speaking. However, Ladislaw's coaching was forthwith to be put to the test, for before the day of nomination, Mr. Brooke was to explain himself to the worthy electors of Middlemarch from the balcony of the White Hart, which looked out advantageously at an angle of the marketplace, commanding a large area in front and two converging streets. It was a fine May morning, and everything seemed hopeful. There was some prospect of an understanding between Bagster's committee and Brooke's, to which Mr. Bulstrode, Mr. Standish as a Liberal lawyer, and such manufacturers as Mr. Plimdale and Mr. Vincey gave a solidity which almost counterbalanced Mr. Hawley and his associates, who sat for Pinkerton at the Green Dragon. Mr. Brooke, conscious of having weakened the blasts of the trumpet against him by his reforms as a landlord in the last half year, and hearing himself cheered a little as he drove into the town, felt his heart tolerably light under his buff-coloured waistcoat. But with regard to critical occasions, it often happens that all moments seem comfortably remote until the last.
"This looks well, eh?" said Mr. Brooke, as the crowd gathered. "I shall have a good audience, at any rate. I like this now, this kind of public made up of one's own neighbours, you know."
The weavers and tanners of Middlemarch, unlike Mr. Mormsey, had never thought of Mr. Brooke as a neighbour, and were not more attached to him than if he had been sent in a box from London. But they listened without much disturbance to the speakers who introduced the candidate, though one of them, a political personage from Brassing, who came to tell Middlemarch its duty, spoke so fully that it was alarming to think what the candidate could find to say after him. Meanwhile, the crowd became denser. And as the political personage neared the end of his speech, Mr. Brooke felt a remarkable change in his sensations. While he still handled his eyeglass, trifled with documents before him, and exchanged remarks with his committee as a man to whom the moment of summons was indifferent.
"I'll take another glass of sherry, Ladislaw," he said, with an easy air to Will, who was close behind him, and presently handed him the supposed fortifier.
It was ill chosen, for Mr. Brooke was an abstemious man, and to drink a second glass of sherry quickly at no great interval from the first was a surprise to his system, which tended to scatter his energies instead of collecting them. Pray pity him. So many English gentlemen make themselves miserable by speechifying on entirely private grounds, whereas Mr. Brooke wished to serve his country by standing for Parliament, which indeed may also be done on private grounds, but being once undertaken does absolutely demand some speechifying. It was not about the beginning of his speech that Mr. Brooke was at all anxious. This, he felt sure, would be all right. He should have it quite pat, cut out as neatly as a set of couplets from Pope. Embarking would be easy. But the vision of open sea that might come after was alarming. And questions now, hinted the demon just waking up in his stomach. Somebody may put questions about the schedules.
Ladislaw, he continued aloud, just hand me the memorandum of the schedules.
When Mr. Brooke presented himself on the balcony, the cheers were quite loud enough to counterbalance the yells, groans, brayings, and other expressions of adverse theory, which were so moderate that Mr. Standish, decidedly an old bird, observed in the ear next to him,
"This looks dangerous, by God. Hawley has got some deeper plan than this."
Still, the cheers were exhilarating, and no candidate could look more amiable than Mr. Brooke, with the memorandum in his breast pocket, his left hand on the rail of the balcony, and his right trifling with his eyeglass. The striking points in his appearance were his buff waistcoat, short-clipped blonde hair, and neutral physiognomy. He began with some confidence.
"Gentlemen, electors of Middlemarch."
This was so much the right thing that a little pause after it seemed natural.
"I'm uncommonly glad to be here. I was never so proud and happy in my life. Never so happy, you know."
This was a bold figure of speech, but not exactly the right thing, for unhappily the pat opening had slipped away. Even couplets from Pope may be but fallings from us, vanishings, when fear clutches us and a glass of sherry is hurrying like smoke among our ideas. Ladislaw, who stood at the window behind the speaker, thought, "It's all up now. The only chance is that since the best thing won't always do, floundering may answer for once." Mr. Brooke, meanwhile, having lost other clues, fell back on himself and his qualifications, always an appropriate, graceful subject for a candidate.
"I am a close neighbour of yours, my good friends. You've known me on the bench a good while. I've always gone a good deal into public questions, machinery now and machine breaking. You're many of you concerned with machinery, and I've been going into that lately. It won't do, you know, breaking machines. Everything must go on. Trade, manufacturers, commerce, interchange of staples, that kind of thing. Since Adam Smith, that must go on. We must look all over the globe. Observation with extensive view. Must look everywhere from China to Peru, as somebody says. Johnson, I think. The Rambler, you know. That is what I have done, up to a certain point. Not as far as Peru, but I've not always stayed at home. I saw it wouldn't do. I've been in the Levant, where some of your Middlemarch goods go, and then again in the Baltic. The Baltic, now."
Plying among his recollections in this way, Mr. Brooke might have got along easily to himself and would have come back from the remotest seas without trouble. But a diabolical procedure had been set up by the enemy. At one and the same moment, there had risen above the shoulders of the crowd, nearly opposite Mr. Brooke and within 10 yards of him, the effigy of himself, buff-coloured waistcoat, eyeglass, and neutral physiognomy painted on rag. And there had arisen apparently in the air, like the note of the cuckoo, a parrot-like, punch-voiced echo of his words. Everybody looked up at the open windows in the houses at the opposite angles of the converging streets, but they were either blank or filled by laughing listeners. The most innocent echo has an impish mockery in it when it follows a gravely persistent speaker, and this echo was not at all innocent. If it did not follow with the precision of a natural echo, it had a wicked choice of the words it overtook. By the time it said, "The Baltic now!" the laugh which had been running through the audience became a general shout, and but for the sobering effects of party and that great public cause which the entanglement of things had identified with Brooke of Tipton, the laugh might have caught his committee. Mr. Bulstrode asked reprehensively what the new police was doing, but a voice could not well be collared, and an attack on the effigy of the candidate would have been too equivocal, since Hawley probably meant it to be pelted. Mr. Brooke himself was not in a position to be quickly conscious of anything except a general slipping away of ideas within himself. He had even a little singing in the ears, and he was the only person who had not yet taken distinct account of the echo or discerned the image of himself. Few things hold the perceptions more thoroughly captive than anxiety about what we have got to say. Mr. Brooke heard the laughter, but he had expected some Tory efforts at disturbance, and he was at this moment additionally excited by the tickling, stinging sense that his lost exordium was coming back to fetch him from the Baltic.
"That reminds me," he went on, thrusting a hand into his side pocket with an easy air. "If I wanted a precedent, you know, but we never want a precedent for the right thing. But there is Chatham now. I can't say I should have supported Chatham or Pitt, the younger Pitt. He was not a man of ideas, and we want ideas, you know."
"Blast your ideas, we want the bill,"
said a loud, rough voice from the crowd below. Immediately the invisible Punch, who had hitherto followed Mr. Brooke, repeated,
Blast your ideas! We want the bill!
The laugh was louder than ever, and for the first time Mr. Brooke, being himself silent, heard distinctly the mocking echo. But it seemed to ridicule his interrupter, and in that light was encouraging. So he replied with amenity,
"There is something in what you say, my good friend, and what do we meet for but to speak our minds? Freedom of opinion, freedom of the press, liberty, that kind of thing. The bill now? You shall have the bill."
Here Mr. Brooke paused a moment to fix on his eyeglass and take the paper from his breast pocket, with a sense of being practical and coming to particulars. The invisible punch followed.
"You shall have the bill, Mr. Brooke, per electioneering contest and a seat outside Parliament as delivered. £5,000, 7 shillings and 4 pence.
Mr. Brooke, amid the roars of laughter, turned red, let his eyeglass fall, and looking about him confusedly, saw the image of himself, which had come nearer. The next moment he saw it dolorously bespattered with eggs. His spirit rose a little, and his voice too.
"Buffoonery, tricks, ridicule the test of truth. All that is very well."
Here an unpleasant egg broke on Mr. Brooke's shoulder, as the echo said,
"All that is very well."
Then came a hail of eggs, chiefly aimed at the image, but occasionally hitting the original as if by chance. There was a stream of new men pushing among the crowd. Whistles, yells, bellowings and fifes made all the greater hubbub because there was shouting and struggling to put them down. No voice would have had wing enough to rise above the uproar, and Mr. Brooke, disagreeably anointed, stood his ground no longer. The frustration would have been less exasperating if it had been less gamesome and boyish. A serious assault, of which the newspaper reporter can aver that it endangered the learned gentleman's ribs, or can respectfully bear witness to the soles of that gentleman's boots having been visible above the railing, has perhaps more consolations attached to it. Mr. Brooke re-entered the committee room, saying as carelessly as he could, "This is a little too bad, you know. I should have got the ear of the people by and by, but they didn't give me time. I should have gone into the bill by and by, you know," he added, glancing at Ladislaw. "However, things will come all right at the nomination." But it was not resolved unanimously that things would come right. On the contrary, the committee looked rather grim, and the political personage from Brassing was writing busily, as if he were brewing new devices.
"It was Bowyer who did it," said Mr. Standish evasively. "I know it as well as if he had been advertised. He's uncommonly good at ventriloquism, and he did it uncommonly well, by God. Hawley has been having him to dinner lately. There's a fund of talent in Bowyer."
"Well, you know, you never mentioned him to me, Standish, else I would have invited him to dine," said poor Mr. Brooke, who had gone through a great deal of inviting for the good of his country.
"There's not a more paltry fellow in Middlemarch than Bowyer," said Ladislaw indignantly. "But it seems as if the paltry fellows were always to turn the scale." Will was thoroughly out of temper with himself as well as with his principal, and he went to shut himself in his rooms with a half-formed resolve to throw up the Pioneer and Mr. Brooke together. Why should he stay? If the impassable gulf between himself and Dorothea were ever to be filled up, it must rather be by his going away and getting into a thoroughly different position than by staying here and slipping into deserved contempt as an understrapper of Brooks. Then came the young dream of wonders that he might do. In 5 years, for example, political writing, political speaking, would get a higher value now public life was going to be wider and more national, and they might give him such distinction that he would not seem to be asking Dorothea to step down to him. 5 years. If he could only be sure that she cared for him more than for others. If he could only make her aware that he stood aloof until he could tell his love without lowering himself. Then he could go away easily, and begin a career which at 25 seemed probable enough in the inward order of things, where talent brings fame, and fame everything else which is delightful. He could speak, and he could write. He could master any subject if he chose. And he meant always to take the side of reason and justice, on which he would carry all his ardour. Why should he not one day be lifted above the shoulders of the crowd and feel that he had won that eminence well? Without doubt, he would leave Middlemarch, go to town, and make himself fit for celebrity by eating his dinners. But not immediately. Not until some kind of sign had passed between him and Dorothea. He could not be satisfied until she knew why, even if he were the man she would choose to marry, he would not marry her. Hence, he must keep his post and bear with Mr. Brooke a little longer. But he soon had reason to suspect that Mr. Brooke had anticipated him in the wish to break up their connection. Deputations without and voices within had concurred in inducing that philanthropist to take a stronger measure than usual for the good of mankind, namely, to withdraw in favour of another candidate, to whom he left the advantages of his canvassing machinery. He himself called this a strong measure, but observed that his health was less capable of sustaining excitement than he had imagined. "I have felt uneasy about the chest. It won't do to carry that too far," he said to Ladislaw in explaining the affair. "I must pull up. Poor Casaubon was a warning, you know. I've made some heavy advances, but I've dug a channel. It's rather coarse work, this electioneering, eh, Ladislaw? I dare say you are tired of it. However, we have dug a channel with the Pioneer, put things in a track and so on. A more ordinary man than you might carry it on now. More ordinary, you know." "Do you wish me to give it up?" said Will, the quick colour coming in his face as he rose from the writing table and took a turn of three steps with his hands in his pockets. "I am ready to do so whenever you wish it." "As to wishing, my dear Ladislaw, I have the highest opinion of your powers, you know. But about the Pioneer, I have been consulting a little with some of the men on our side, and they are inclined to take it into their hands. Indemnify me to a certain extent. Carry it on, in fact. And under the circumstances, you might like to give up, might find a better field. These people might not take that high view of you which I have always taken, as an alter ego, a right hand. Though I always looked forward to your doing something else. I think of having a run into France. But I'll write you any letters, you know, to Althorpe and people of that kind. I've met Althorpe." "I am exceedingly obliged to you," said Ladislaw proudly. "Since you are going to part with the Pioneer, I need not trouble you about the steps I shall take. I may choose to continue here for the present." After Mr. Brooke had left him, Will said to himself, "The rest of the family have been urging him to get rid of me, and he doesn't care now about my going. I shall stay as long as I like. I shall go of my own movement, and not because they are afraid of me." Chapter 52. On that June evening when Mr. Fairbrother knew that he was to have the Lowick living, there was joy in the old-fashioned parlour, and even the portraits of the great lawyers seemed to look on with satisfaction. His mother left her tea and toast untouched, but sat with her usual pretty primness, only showing her emotion by that flush in the cheeks and brightness in the eyes, which give an old woman a touching momentary identity with her far-off youthful self, and saying decisively, "The greatest comfort, Camden, is that you have deserved it." "When a man gets a good berth, mother, half the deserving must come after," said the son, brimful of pleasure, and not trying to conceal it. The gladness in his face was of that active kind, which seems to have energy enough not only to flash outwardly, but to light up busy vision within. One seemed to see thoughts as well as delight in his glances. "Now, aunt," he went on, rubbing his hands and looking at Miss Noble, who was making tender little beaver-like noises, "there shall be sugar candy always on the table for you to steal and give to the children, and you shall have a great many new stockings to make presents of, and you shall darn your own more than ever." Miss Noble nodded at her nephew, with a subdued, half-frightened laugh, conscious of having already dropped an additional lump of sugar into her basket on the strength of the new preferment. "As for you, Winnie," the vicar went on, "I shall make no difficulty about your marrying any Lowick bachelor. Mr. Solomon Featherstone, for example, as soon as I find you are in love with him." Miss Winifred, who had been looking at her brother all the while and crying heartily, which was her way of rejoicing, smiled through her tears and said, "You must set me the example, Cam. You must marry now." "With all my heart.
but who is in love with me? I am a seedy old fellow, said the vicar, rising, pushing his chair away and looking down at himself. What do you say, mother?
You are a handsome man, Camden, though not so fine a figure of a man as your father, said the old lady.
I wish you would marry Miss Garth, brother, said Miss Winifred. She would make us so lively at Lowick. Very fine. You talk as if young women were tied up to be chosen like poultry at market, as if I had only to ask and everybody would have me, said the vicar, not caring to specify. We don't want everybody, said Miss Winifred. But you would like Miss Garth, mother, shouldn't you?
My son's choice shall be mine, said Mrs. Fairbrother, with majestic discretion. And a wife would be most welcome, Camden. You will want your whist at home when we go to Lowick, and Henrietta Noble never was a whist player.
Mrs. Fairbrother always called her tiny old sister by that magnificent name. I shall do without whist now, mother.
Why so, Camden? In my time, whist was thought an undeniable amusement for a good churchman, said Mrs. Fairbrother, innocent of the meaning that whist had for her son, and speaking rather sharply, as at some dangerous countenancing of new doctrine.
I shall be too busy for whist. I shall have two parishes, said the vicar, preferring not to discuss the virtues of that game.
He had already said to Dorothea,
I don't feel bound to give up St. Botolph's. It is protest enough against the pluralism they want to reform if I give somebody else most of the money. The stronger thing is not to give up power, but to use it well.
I have thought of that, said Dorothea. So far as self is concerned, I think it would be easier to give up power and money than to keep them. It seems very unfitting that I should have this patronage, yet I felt that I ought not to let it be used by someone else instead of me.
It is I who am bound to act so that you will not regret your power, said Mr. Fairbrother. His was one of the natures in which conscience gets the more active when the yoke of life ceases to gall them. He made no display of humility on the subject, but in his heart he felt rather ashamed that his conduct had shown laches which others who did not get benefices were free from. I used often to wish I had been something else than a clergyman, he said to Lydgate, but perhaps it will be better to try and make as good a clergyman out of myself as I can. That is the well-beneficed point of view, you perceive, from which difficulties are much simplified, he ended, smiling. The vicar did feel then as if his share of duties would be easy. But duty has a trick of behaving unexpectedly, something like a heavy friend whom we have amiably asked to visit us, and who breaks his leg within our gates. Hardly a week later, duty presented itself in his study under the disguise of Fred Vincey, now returned from Omnibus College with his bachelor's degree.
"I'm ashamed to trouble you, Mr. Fairbrother," said Fred, whose fair open face was propitiating. "But you are the only friend I can consult. I told you everything once before, and you were so good that I can't help coming to you again."
"Sit down, Fred. I'm ready to hear and do anything I can," said the vicar, who was busy packing some small objects for removal and went on with his work.
"I wanted to tell you..." Fred hesitated an instant, and then went on plungingly. "I might go into the church now, and really, look where I may, I can't see anything else to do. I don't like it, but I know it's uncommonly hard on my father to say so after he has spent a good deal of money in educating me for it." Fred paused again an instant, and then repeated, "And I can't see anything else to do."
"I did talk to your father about it, Fred, but I made little way with him. He said it was too late. But you have got over one bridge now. What are your other difficulties?"
"Merely that I don't like it. I don't like divinity and preaching and feeling obliged to look serious. I like riding across country and doing as other men do. I don't mean that I want to be a bad fellow in any way, but I've no taste for the sort of thing people expect of a clergyman. And yet what else am I to do? My father can't spare me any capital, else I might go into farming. And he has no room for me in his trade. And of course I can't begin to study for law or physic now, when my father wants me to earn something. It's all very well to say I'm wrong to go into the church, but those who say so might as well tell me to go into the backwoods."
Fred's voice had taken a tone of grumbling remonstrance, and Mr. Fairbrother might have been inclined to smile
if his mind had not been too busy in imagining more than Fred told him. "Have you any difficulties about doctrines? About the articles?" he said, trying hard to think of the question simply for Fred's sake. "No, I suppose the articles are right. I am not prepared with any arguments to disprove them, and much better, cleverer fellows than I am go in for them entirely. I think it would be rather ridiculous in me to urge scruples of that sort as if I were a judge," said Fred, quite simply. "I suppose, then, it has occurred to you that you might be a fair parish priest, without being much of a divine?" "Of course, if I am obliged to be a clergyman, I shall try and do my duty, though I mayn't like it. Do you think anybody ought to blame me?" "For going into the church under the circumstances?" "That depends on your conscience, Fred. How far you have counted the cost and seen what your position will require of you. I can only tell you about myself that I have always been too lax and have been uneasy in consequence." "But there is another hindrance," said Fred, colouring. "I did not tell you before, though perhaps I may have said things that made you guess it. There is somebody I am very fond of. I have loved her ever since we were children." "Miss Garth, I suppose," said the vicar, examining some labels very closely. "Yes, I shouldn't mind anything if she would have me, and I know I could be a good fellow then."
"And do you think she returns the feeling?"
"She never will say so, and a good while ago she made me promise not to speak to her about it again, and she has set her mind especially against my being a clergyman. I know that, but I can't give her up. I do think she cares about me. I saw Mrs. Garth last night, and she said that Mary was staying at Lowick Rectory with Miss Fairbrother."
"Yes, she is very kindly helping my sister. Do you wish to go there?"
"No. I want to ask a great favour of you. I'm ashamed to bother you in this way. But Mary might listen to what you said, if you mentioned the subject to her. I mean, about my going into the church."
"That is rather a delicate task, my dear Fred. I shall have to presuppose your attachment to her, and to enter on the subject as you wish me to do will be asking her to tell me whether she returns it."
"That is what I want her to tell you," said Fred bluntly. "I don't know what to do unless I can get at her feeling."
"You mean that you would be guided by that as to your going into the church?"
"If Mary said she would never have me, I might as well go wrong in one way as another."
"That is nonsense, Fred. Men outlive their love, but they don't outlive the consequences of their recklessness."
"Not my sort of love. I have never been without loving Mary. If I had to give her up, it would be like beginning to live on wooden legs."
"Will she not be hurt at my intrusion?"
"No, I feel sure she will not. She respects you more than anyone, and she would not put you off with fun as she does me. Of course, I could not have told anyone else, or asked anyone else to speak to her but you. There is no one else who could be such a friend to both of us."
Fred paused a moment, and then said, rather complainingly, "And she ought to acknowledge that I have worked in order to pass. She ought to believe that I would exert myself for her sake." There was a moment's silence before Mr. Fairbrother laid down his work, and putting out his hand to Fred, said, "Very well, my boy. I will do what you wish." That very day, Mr. Fairbrother went to Lowick Parsonage on the nag which he had just set up. "Decidedly, I am an old stork," he thought. "The young growths are pushing me aside." He found Mary in the garden, gathering roses and sprinkling the petals on a sheet. The sun was low, and tall trees sent their shadows across the grassy walks where Mary was moving without bonnet or parasol. She did not observe Mr. Fairbrother's approach along the grass, and had just stooped down to lecture a small black-and-tan terrier, which would persist in walking on the sheet and smelling at the rose-leaves as Mary sprinkled them. She took his forepaws in one hand and lifted up the forefinger of the other, while the dog wrinkled his brows and looked embarrassed. "Fly! Fly, I am ashamed of you," Mary was saying in a grave contralto. "This is not becoming in a sensible dog. Anybody would think you were a silly young gentleman." "You are unmerciful to young gentlemen, Miss Garth," said the vicar, within 2 yards of her. Mary started up and blushed.
"It always answers to reason with Fly," she said laughingly. "But not with young gentlemen." "Oh, with some, I suppose, since some of them turn into excellent men." "I am glad of that admission, because I want at this very moment to interest you in a young gentleman." "Not a silly one, I hope," said Mary, beginning to pluck the roses again, and feeling her heart beat uncomfortably. "No, though perhaps wisdom is not his strong point, but rather affection and sincerity. However, wisdom lies more in those two qualities than people are apt to imagine. I hope you know by those marks what young gentleman I mean." "Yes, I think I do," said Mary bravely, her face getting more serious and her hands cold. "It must be Fred Vincey." "He has asked me to consult you about his going into the church. I hope you will not think that I consented to take a liberty in promising to do so." "On the contrary, Mr. Fairbrother," said Mary, giving up the roses and folding her arms, but unable to look up. "Whenever you have anything to say to me, I feel honoured. But before I enter on that question, let me just touch a point on which your father took me into confidence. By the way, it was that very evening on which I once before fulfilled a mission from Fred, just after he had gone to college. Mr. Garth told me what happened on the night of Featherstone's death, how you refused to burn the will, and he said that you had some heart prickings on that subject because you had been the innocent means of hindering Fred from getting his £10,000. I have kept that in mind, and I have heard something that may relieve you on that score, may show you that no sin offering is demanded from you there." Mr. Fairbrother paused a moment and looked at Mary. He meant to give Fred his full advantage, but it would be well, he thought, to clear her mind of any superstitions, such as women sometimes follow when they do a man the wrong of marrying him as an act of atonement. Mary's cheeks had begun to burn a little, and she was mute. "I mean that your action made no real difference to Fred's lot. I find that the first will would not have been legally good after the burning of the last. It would not have stood if it had been disputed, and you may be sure it would have been disputed. So on that score, you may feel your mind free." "Thank you, Mr. Fairbrother," said Mary earnestly. "I am grateful to you for remembering my feelings." "Well, now I may go on. Fred, you know, has taken his degree. He has worked his way so far. And now the question is, what is he to do? That question is so difficult that he is inclined to follow his father's wishes and enter the church, though you know better than I do that he was quite set against that formerly. I have questioned him on the subject, and I confess I see no insuperable objection to his being a clergyman as things go. He says that he could turn his mind to doing his best in that vocation, on one condition. If that condition were fulfilled, I would do my utmost in helping Fred on. After a time, not of course at first, he might be with me as my curate. And he would have so much to do that his stipend would be nearly what I used to get as vicar. But I repeat that there is a condition, without which all this cannot come to pass. He has opened his heart to me, Miss Garth, and asked me to plead for him. The condition lies entirely in your feeling." Mary looked so much moved that he said after a moment, "Let us walk a little." And when they were walking, he added, "To speak quite plainly, Fred will not take any course which would lessen the chance that you would consent to be his wife. But with that prospect, he will try his best at anything you approve." "I cannot possibly say that I will ever be his wife, Mr. Fairbrother, but I certainly never will be his wife if he becomes a clergyman. What you say is most generous and kind. I don't mean for a moment to correct your judgment. It is only that I have my girlish, mocking way of looking at things," said Mary, with a returning sparkle of playfulness in her answer, which only made its modesty more charming. "He wishes me to report exactly what you think," said Mr. Fairbrother. "I could not love a man who is ridiculous," said Mary, not choosing to go deeper. "Fred has sense and knowledge enough to make him respectable if he likes in some good worldly business, but I can never imagine him preaching and exhorting and pronouncing blessings and praying by the sick without feeling as if I were looking at a caricature. His being a clergyman would be only for gentility's sake, and I think there is nothing more contemptible than such imbecile gentility. I used to think that of Mr. Crowse, with his empty face and neat umbrella and mincing little speeches. What right have such men to represent Christianity, as if it were an institution for getting up idiots genteelly, as if... Mary checked herself. She had been carried along as if she had been speaking to Fred instead of Mr. Fairbrother.
Young women are severe. They don't feel the stress of action as men do, though perhaps I ought to make you an exception there. But you don't put Fred Vincey on so low a level as that.
No, indeed. He has plenty of sense, but I think he would not show it as a clergyman. He would be a piece of professional affectation.
Then the answer is quite decided. As a clergyman, he could have no hope.
Mary shook her head.
But if he braved all the difficulties of getting his bread in some other way, will you give him the support of hope? May he count on winning you?
I think Fred ought not to need telling again what I have already said to him, Mary answered with a slight resentment in her manner. I mean that he ought not to put such questions until he has done something worthy, instead of saying that he could do it.
Mr. Fairbrother was silent for a minute or more, and then, as they turned and paused under the shadow of a maple at the end of a grassy walk, said,
"I understand that you resist any attempt to fetter you, but either your feeling for Fred Vincey excludes your entertaining another attachment, or it does not. Either he may count on your remaining single until he shall have earned your hand, or he may in any case be disappointed. Pardon me, Mary. You know I used to catechise you under that name. But when the state of a woman's affections touches the happiness of another life, of more lives than one, I think it would be the nobler course for her to be perfectly direct and open."
Mary in her turn was silent, wondering not at Mr. Fairbrother's manner, but at his tone, which had a grave, restrained emotion in it. When the strange idea flashed across her that his words had reference to himself, she was incredulous and ashamed of entertaining it. She had never thought that any man could love her except Fred, who had espoused her with the umbrella ring when she wore socks and little strapped shoes. Still less that she could be of any importance to Mr. Fairbrother, the cleverest man in her narrow circle. She had only time to feel that all this was hazy and perhaps illusory. But one thing was clear and determined, her answer.
"Since you think it my duty, Mr. Fairbrother, I will tell you that I have too strong a feeling for Fred to give him up for anyone else. I should never be quite happy if I thought he was unhappy for the loss of me. It has taken such deep root in me, my gratitude to him for always loving me best, and minding so much if I hurt myself, from the time when we were very little. I cannot imagine any new feeling coming to make that weaker. I should like better than anything to see him worthy of everyone's respect. But please tell him I will not promise to marry him till then. I should shame and grieve my father and mother. He is free to choose someone else."
"Then I have fulfilled my commission thoroughly," said Mr. Fairbrother, putting out his hand to Mary. "And I shall ride back to Middlemarch forthwith. With this prospect before him, we shall get Fred into the right niche somehow, and I hope I shall live to join your hands. God bless you."
"Oh, please stay and let me give you some tea," said Mary. Her eyes filled with tears, for something indefinable, something like the resolute suppression of a pain in Mr. Fairbrother's manner, made her feel suddenly miserable, as she had once felt when she saw her father's hands trembling in a moment of trouble.
"No, my dear, no. I must get back."
In 3 minutes, the vicar was on horseback again, having gone magnanimously through a duty much harder than the renunciation of whist, or even than the writing of penitential meditations.
End of disc 16.